sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Greek opposition party claims victory. Draghi fires his bazooka, and markets are positive on the year and then retreat. We have great guests today, Tom Wheelwright on oil and Das on the global condition. All this and much more on episode number 397 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And hello and welcome, Andrew Horowitz here. It is episode number 397, coming up on the end of January 2015. And we did see that, of course, the much-anticipated week where the ECB would come out with some kind of quantitative easing program. And at first, it was concerning because they leaked the information on Wednesday that about 55 billion euros would be used on a monthly basis to provide some kind of bond-buying program. And markets were okay with it, but the euro popped actually higher. It could have been a little bit of short covering in front of the big news that was expected the next day, but magically, we got 60 or so billion dollars per month. And there's a bit of a time frame on it. And there's some cost sharing. And there's going to be some discussion we're going to have with Das today, because he's the expert on that area. And I want to talk to him about that, because I want to understand more about what is going on in Europe. But I will tell you, it looks like a big trial balloon that went up, and that they saw that the markets were not really impressed with the numbers, so they just switched it around the next day. Surely they figure that they can manipulate the overall sentiment of markets. And they did so pretty well. Now, with that, the euro dropped on Thursday. It dropped on Friday. Some are now calling for parity. And I love that when we see that out of the woodwork, we see all of these fellas and gals come out and talk about how, we called it so right. And, you know, we have all this money on the short side of the euro right now. The more we see of that, the more I start thinking that it's time to go long the euro. Maybe not just about now, but, you know, with a full position. But we've started actually adding to a position of short dollar, long euro, looking for maybe some turnaround. Well, we'll see what happens. We'll manage that as we go along. And if you know what we've told you all along for years now, and trying to be disciplined, is to understand where your stops are, where your targets are, and maybe where the levels of technicals are. And we're going to look for those and find where we have on the euro to find if there's a place that's the good level of support. And if so, what we're going to do is we're going to add on to it, and we're going to start pressing it, because when you do see that turn, when you do see the short start covering, it's a wonderful opportunity. You may see a major bounce on this, maybe temporary, but a major bounce on this. Now, as we see that the U.S. economic data is coming out a little bit weaker, even though leading indicators came out a little bit stronger than expected, we did see that housing numbers were weaker, and this goes along with several of the other indicators that we saw over the last few weeks that were a little bit soft, aside from employment. That could put a damper on the rally we're seeing in the dollar. Depends on how bad it is. Depends on if we're going to see more of it, if it's just a few here and there, or if we're going to string a few together. And that would be very detrimental to the euro in terms of the downside. It would probably be a bit more upside for the euro, downside for the dollar. Now, we also saw over the weekend that it was a very interesting thing. The Greek election occurred and the opposition party did win. Now the big question is, what is going to happen next? Because, you know, what we did talk about last week is the potential for this party to come in and say, you know what, all bets are off. We're not paying the debt. We want a restructuring of this. We want you to drop a lot of it. And if you don't, you know what we're going to do? We're going to pull out of the euro. Now that would be very bad. See, there's a no win right now for the eurozone. If they give in to the demands of the party that is coming into power that won the election, what makes anybody think that Portugal, Spain, Italy, Cyprus, any of those countries aren't going to do the same thing and try to see if they can weasel out of the obligations they have on the monies they have from the bailout, hundreds of billions of dollars. If, on the other hand, they throw Greece out of the euro and the eurozone, or they voluntarily leave the eurozone, if that can happen somehow, it's going to be a disaster. The unwinding of bonds, the unwinding of currencies, the unwinding of the trade agreements between Greece and the eurozone, it's just a real problem. So we're going to have to watch what happens with this. When the news came out and when futures opened overnight on Sunday, they were relatively weak. The euro came down pretty hard and then bounced back a bit and stabilized. We'll see what happens here. Gold, silver, moving higher. Oil initially moved lower, but then it came back a bit. But we do have two guests today, two great guests, and I really wanted to focus in on a discussion with them. So we're going to get to them very quickly today. Of course, if you have any questions, do me a favor. Send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if, in fact, you are interested in any of the strategies that we manage for clients, whether it is the Arrow, which is our algorithmic strategy, our trading strategy, which is TDI, the Disciplined Investor, Managed Growth Strategy, or our global allocations, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check out the things that we have on the site where you can get more information or see some videos like the virtual tour that's available. Our first guest today is Tom Wheelwright, CPA and CEO of Provision Wealth, which is a leading tax and wealth expert. He is speaker and a publisher. He's published the book Tax-Free Wealth is number one on Amazon in the corporate category, on a partnerships and old things about corporate tax strategies. Actually, there's a lot of things going on in the area of taxes these days, too. But we're going to kind of focus in on the whole idea of oil. So, my friend, Tom, how are you?
Great. Great to be on the show, Andrew. Thank you.
So there's a lot to talk about with oil. It's an amazing thing that back only a few years ago, everybody was talking about peak oil and that we're running out and that there was no more oil to be had. And we better be careful. And we're, you know, using up all of the natural resources. And then all of a sudden, here we are, fast forward to, oh, my God, there's too much oil. What are we going to do with it? What's happened?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of funny. I look at the oil and what's going on here. You can draw a direct parallel on oil with what happened in real estate in 2007, 2008, 2009. You know, people go, well, you know, in 2007, everybody was talking about, oh, well, we keep putting money into real estate. Prices kept going up. Everybody's buying. It's great. And then all of a sudden it crashes. Why? Because there's too much real estate. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are putting too much money into it. What happens is when you have those prices the way they are and the cap rates where they are, the return rates the way they are, then people build a lot. So now there's a glut. Well, it's the same thing that happened in oil. I mean, so what happened is the fracking industry in oil, they figured it out basically. And everybody gets into it, and now all these marginal people get into it. It should never be in oil in the first place, just like the marginal people got into real estate in 2006, 2007. And all of a sudden now, wow, gee, surprise, we got too much oil because everybody's in there producing. It's exactly the same. To me, there's just direct parallels.
So what you're saying is, just to kind of just restate the point that you just made, was that there was so much excitement over oil and the opportunity to make money in it that everybody and their brother got into it in terms of drilling and research and looking at refining. And there was just so much opportunity there that what they did is they went out and spent all sorts of money to get this done. And they did so. And it was great. And they found oil. And there was this great boom of opportunity for them. But unfortunately, because of what they did, there was too much oil found. And therefore, there's too much supply, and the old supply-demand situation plays out here. And therefore, oil prices plummet. Now, with real estate, there was a bailout. The banks got hurt. Individuals got hurt. And the economy got hurt. With oil, does that parallel from real estate follow through to how there is an effect potentially on the economy? Because there's a lot of people that are talking about how lower oil prices are just absolutely terrific. You know, you got the benefit of the fact that prices at the pump are much lower for gas. Petroleum products that are made, there's just hundreds of them that are made from oil. are less costly, so therefore input price will go down. Therefore, the cost for those products to manufacture will go down. Maybe margins will go up for companies, and the end product will be cheaper. Well, that leads me to a deflationary discussion, but okay, is the same going to happen? Are we going to see a bailout?
Well,
I don't know who it would be, but I'm just wondering.
I don't think we're going to see a bailout. I think what we're seeing is we are seeing the same thing that happened from an investment standpoint. We're seeing a lot of the marginal producers are going out of business, and they should. Okay, that was a positive that came out of the crash in 2008-2009, was a lot of the marginal real estate investors got pushed out of the market. Mm-hmm. That's great. The difference is I do think that you have some similarities in from a banking standpoint, because you do have a lot of leverage in oil and gas. I mean, you do have a lot of these developers. They went out, borrowed money, and is it going to put some pressure on the banks? I think it'll put some pressure on some banks. The major difference is real estate is a much bigger part of the day-to-day economy, as far as, you know, you have Joe average. I mean, we had grocery clerks who were, you know, investing in real estate in 2006,
yep,
right?
Yep.
We don't have grocery clerks.
Well, but let me stop you. Not to disparage the grocery clerks, what you're saying is not only investing, but leveraging up to buy it as an investment on top of maybe even the main property they owned.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And plus they were leveraging up to buy their own property. We don't have people doing that in oil and gas. Oil and gas is a much smaller market from an investment standpoint, as you know. So I don't think we have the same overall impact. You know, when real estate crashes like that, it impacts a lot more people. And a lot more banks than when oil crashes. Oil crashes, there are some banks that are going to be absolutely devastated. And we've seen it in other oil crashes, you know, in Texas in the early 80s, that, you know, Houston just like died for like what, 5, 6, 7 years,
yeah,
in the early 80s.
And then made a major comeback, obviously.
Right. North Dakota is going to die. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they've had this huge boom. There's nothing else there. I mean, that's the problem with North Dakota. They don't have a Gulf. They don't have other things. They just have oil. So I think they're going to get hammered. I think Texas has done a good job diversifying their economy anyway. So I don't think we're Lubbock and Midland, they're going to be hammered. Okay, they're just a boom and bust town. That's what they are, and you know, they're in bust mode. But I actually do think it'll have, at least initially, it'll have some kind of a stimulus to the economy. You know, the challenge is, you know, it's like $800 per person is what they estimate in a average person's pocket from lower pump prices. Where's that money going to go? Well, you know, it's going to go to China, right? It's going to go to Walmart.
Well, so, yeah, that's a good point. But the other thing is that similar to the banking situation in real estate, is that I foresee one of the opportunities, and you have to be careful, and we'll talk about this, but one of the opportunities is that the smaller players take some of the already confirmed wells in North Dakota and in Texas and all over the country in the U.S. Well, because they're much higher cost to manufacture, produce, bring it up, and then get it out, a lot of these companies are not going to do well. So the real question is, are there going to be some amazing amount of mergers, acquisitions going on in the next, let's call it 12 to 18 months that we'll see? Because a lot of these companies are having a lot of problems. Maybe the big companies like the Exxons, the Chevrons will come in and say, hey, you know what? There's something interesting. What we could do is we can actually buy this company. And yes, there's a problem right now with the cost of refining and the cost of bringing it up. But they have found and confirmed wells that are ready to go when we just flick a button, and therefore when oil prices go back up, whenever that does happen, if it does happen, that we'll have this great opportunity. Is that something that seems reasonable?
Well, yeah. Let me put it this way. There were a lot of bargains in 2009, 2010 in real estate. There are going to be a lot of bargains in oil, and it's going to be oil leases as well as oil wells. I don't think it's going to be the Mobils and Exxon. It's going to be Continental. It's going to be the next tier down, mm-hmm, that goes in and scoops those up. But I think there are a lot of smaller, what I consider smaller. You know, they're doing, you know, $25-30 million funds, as opposed to the big guys who are, you know, in the billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I think those guys, if you know, just like the best time to invest in real estate was not 2006 at the top of the market, it was 2009, 2010 at the bottom of the market. I think that if you find a driller developer that has the ability to go in and scoop up those bargains, they're going to be there because it's going to be – think about the, you know, all the REO that the banks owned. Same thing's going to happen. The banks are going to end up with these oil rigs, and I think that the smart developers are going to be able to go in and scoop them up at bargain basement prices. Absolutely.
Right, so let's step back a little bit about the global oil situation and why it could be interesting to investors. I mean, is this something that the average investor should be looking at now? Is it going to be actually oil? Is it going to be actually looking at some companies? What's the big picture here in terms of the right here and right now in terms of investing in oil and gas companies?
Or, I think for sure. Now, you know, on the one hand, you know, to the extent that that you're a stock investor, which I'm not. I'm not a stock investor. I'm an oil investor. Okay, for example, if you're a stock investor, then yeah, I would think that oil companies, you know, the extent that they become bargains because their profits are down. Nobody thinks that oil. I mean, the chances are have already passed peak oil, and the fracking is more expensive to get out. And it's only because Saudi Arabia and the Middle East decided not to reduce their oil production that we've got these prices. So nobody thinks that the prices are going to stay this way any more than people thought the real estate was going to stay at the prices of 2009. So you got two choices. You can invest in the stock or you can invest in the oil. You know, when I say I invest in the oil, I don't buy Exxon Mobil. I don't buy stocks. I buy an investment in the well itself. And there's lots of opportunities for that. And when you do that, the added advantage is there's a huge, you knew I was going to bring tax in this, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge tax advantage to invest in the oil well, because you invest in the oil, then your investment, a lot of it's going to be deductible the first you make that investment. Whereas with, you know, stock, you really have to wait until you sell it before you get your investment back.
Right, so you get the depreciation or amortization, you get whatever else is involved in it.
Drilling costs.
Right.
I mean, oil and gas has tax benefits that no other industry has. They're unique.
So when looking at some of these oil and gas investments, I guess they come in MLPs and LPs and things of that nature, right? Mm-hmm. What is it that I really want to look at? What's important to kind of focus in on?
Okay, number one, you want to look at who's the company you're investing with, because there's a lot of sharks. There's a lot of slimy characters in the oil business. So a lot of people get their money ripped off. I mean, that's the first thing. You got to look at who are you dealing with and do your due diligence on that. And then second of all, you have to look at, you do, just like you do real estate, you have to look at, okay, what are their costs of production? What's their engineering like? Have they, what's the cost of getting the oil out of the ground? How much oil is in the ground? I mean, you have to do your due diligence on oil just like you do on real estate.
Hmm. So I guess the big question is that what's the price demarcation point between when it's profitable for some of these small-time players, and I guess it moves around a bit, but what's the general demarcation point between when there's profitability that I need to look at and when they're going to be bleeding? Is it $40? Is it $50? $70? We've heard all sorts of numbers from the U.S.-based companies and the averages, but you know, there was 60 for a while, then it was 50, and as it started going through that, 40, what's the real number?
Well, I think it's a question of, is it just the cost to bring it out of the ground and get it to market? Because if you already have oil, I mean, a lot of these people, they're already pumping, right? So the question is, how much does it cost to pump? I mean, they're already the money they put into the infrastructure, that's a lost cost. That's a sunk cost. So then what you have to look at is, okay, how much does it actually cost to bring it out? Everything I've seen, it looks like for most of them, you're looking at around $30 a barrel. So as long as you're over $30 a barrel, the production is actually profitable to continue pumping. Now, to drill, that's a different question. To drill, it's got to be higher than that, because now you got the additional cost of drilling, and you're, you know, I think you're probably north of, you know, $45-$50 in order to drill. But you could go in and buy up production. I mean, that's the other thing these, I think a lot of these producers are going to do, is they're going to go up, buy up production, wells that are already producing. And then what you're doing is you're buying a stream of income. And the question is, you're buying a stream of income and you're buying it at a price that, okay, you're going to get, you know, your return right now might be 4 or 5%, but when it goes up to 100, it may be, you know, 20%.
Hmm. So do we think that the, in the big picture of things, again, I mean, obviously we know that in the Middle East, that it's much less money, much less cost to actually maintain their profitability. I mean, how far are they going to push this down? That's a good question, right? That's the question, right?
The question is, how far are they going to push it back down, and how long will they push it down?
Right.
And
right, because really, if they leave it at this price and they can continue at this price, the longer they go on with this, the more it hurts.
Well, it hurts them. I mean, the reality is that they make a lot more money at $100 a barrel than they do at $50 a barrel. And what they're doing now clearly is pushing the marginal producers out of the market. And whether their goal is pushing out the U.S. producers, or whether the goal is pushing out the Russia, which seems more likely, is an interesting question. I mean, this certainly hurts Russia more than it hurts the U.S. I think it hurts Canada. You know, it's killing Venezuela. You know, I don't know. I mean, I heard a blurb from Goldman Sachs. They think it's going to go down to 35. So I think we'd be hard pressed to see it go much below 35. You know, because then you just, all of a sudden it comes back up because everybody just stops producing. So there's some pretty good elasticity in oil prices, as we saw. I mean, the oil price came down much faster than the real estate prices came down. So they'll also go up much faster.
Hmm. Well, I'd like to see it, only because it does seem to me that there's something just not right about how oil prices went down when we consider all things around the world. You know, I get how the potential for supply is out there and all that. I understand that. I still wonder also, you know, how much the dollar rise has affected that. But the third part is, I do have the big question mark as to, is there a demand problem? Is there a vat of demand that also is helping to bring oil down, as opposed to just the only having the supply problem?
I don't think there's any question, because China certainly, China's economy was just booming there, and that was pushing up a lot of oil. Remember, they buy, you know, another place we haven't been talking about is Africa, and Africa sells most of its oil to China, and you know, they're completely dependent on that oil. And China, you know, their economy slows down like it has. The question is, will the $800 that goes into Joe taxpayer's pocket here, that goes to China, will that boost China's economy enough to have demand in China? And same with India, same thing.
Well, I got to tell you something. It is a little frightening, though, how fast it did come down. And I think you know, let me ask you this. What indicators should we be watching, aside from maybe the Tuesday, Wednesday inventories, aside from prices? Is something else we should be looking at here to find out what's the inside movement and what we can expect from oil, and maybe some of the things that are important?
You know, I might offer maybe even a different approach than that. Rather than looking at prices and where they're coming down or not, when I'm looking at investing, you know, if I'm looking at investing in oil, I'm looking at, okay, how low can I, you know, what's a good deal? You know, what's a good price for buying production, or what's a good price? And, you know, if we look at a bottom of, you know, to think that the bottom's below 30, I mean, I just can't even possibly imagine the bottom being below that. But if you can make money, if you make money at $30, $35 a barrel,
right,
then I'd be investing with the guys who can make money at $30, $35 a barrel, mm-hmm. and stay away from those who need to, like Venezuela, needs to $85 a barrel to make money. And then go in and look at, I mean, I think there's just a tremendous opportunity for bargains, and will be over the next year to two. Maybe not quite yet, but I think that it's going to come. I think right now we're 2008. Think about, we're 2008, and next year or next summer or next fall, we're going to be 2009, and we're going to start seeing, you know, a lot of bargains. I'd be out there bargain hunting.
I hear you. Well, we're going to end it there. Tom Wheelwright, we'll mention all of your information on the show notes for this episode and how to get in touch with you and find out more about the opportunities in oil and gas. And I appreciate you coming on board today.
Anytime. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Now, our second guest today is Das. You know him. You love him. You got to have him. We haven't had him on for a while, but it is time because there are things that are right in his wheelhouse, right where he belongs to be talking about things related to the euro, things related to oil, markets, currencies, etc. So let's get right into it. Author of Extreme Money and all-around good guy. Hey, Das, what's going on?
Well, I think you said that, you know, where I should be, and I think probably I should join the other people in the madhouse, because I think it's basically all gone crazy.
Yeah.
Obviously, the big news is the ECB's whatever it takes. We now know whatever it takes is, because it's only taken us about 3 years, but we've got to the announcement. And overnight, Mario Draghi obviously came out and came with his package. And I think overall, I think the best way to describe the package is the fact that the ship of state is well and truly marooned on the reefs, and he's basically now decided the time is to change course. So I'm not sure that it's going to do very much, but the basics of the package are $60 billion a month for about 18 months, so about €1 trillion. Why this surprises anybody, I don't know, because he's been saying for a while that he's going to boost the ECB balance sheet by about €1 trillion. Secondly, he's going to buy sovereign debt, asset-backed securities and covered bonds, but not corporate bonds. But the most interesting thing about this is that he's going to buy them in the proportions of the ECB shareholdings, which means he's going to buy a lot of German and French and Italian bonds.
Buying German bonds makes no sense.
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense if you're German.
Well, yeah, right.
But it doesn't make sense in the overall context of things. The other thing I think which is interesting about it is this very weird concept of risk sharing. Because basically the ECB is going to take 20% of the risk, but actually if you read the fine print, it's actually slightly different. Because they're going to buy what are the European supranationals like the European Investment Bank, and that's 12% roughly of the purchase. So effectively it's only 8% of the remainder that's actually covered, which is like 9% of the risk on non-European supranationals is going to be shared, which is tiny. So I actually looked at this and I did some back-of-the-envelope numbers. German risk is actually going to go down because the ECB is buying more German bonds than the risk Germany will end up with, which is kind of weird. But the other thing is, it's classic Europe. You know, there's no details. It's going to start on March 15th. There's not really much in the way of detail. And I was very amused to see Mr. Draghi at some ungodly hour in Australia say, you know, today we are showing that our credibility is deserved. And I thought, you know, he certainly hasn't lost his sense of humor of whatever else has happened. But look, let's just go through this and unpack it. What's it meant to do? Well, firstly, it's meant to restart growth. We don't have a monetary problem anymore. We have a demand problem. And there's no evidence from other places which have tried massive QE programs like Japan and the United States that it's that closely linked to growth. Second thing is they're apparently going to create inflation. You just have to have a look at Japan and the U.S. to see monetary accommodation on its own just doesn't do it. And particularly now, which is slightly different to the Japanese and the U.S. experience, is with oil prices having plummeted, that task is a little bit harder anyway. Then the next question is, well, okay, well, is it going to help the government's finance? Well, there is no problem for the government's financing anyway. And it doesn't actually lower their cost of funding because, look, if Italy can borrow at 1.5%, 1.6%, and they have serious solvency issues, well, I mean, how low do you have to go before you have some effect? And everybody last night, I noticed, was screaming that, you know, Greek bonds had come off. They had. But they're still at 9.5%, for God's sake. You know, it's not going to make that much difference. And then, of course, is the wretched issue of, okay, well, maybe it'll start lending in Europe, And the answer is, I'm not quite sure that it's worked, because the bank balance sheets in the European context have shrunk. And we have no evidence that this is a supply problem. I think it's a demand problem. So all in all, I think, you know, more of the usual. We'll get a lot more Draghi sort of grandstanding. But I think there are a couple of things which now really worry me. The Germans were very, very clearly not upset, but they were really irritated by this. And you could see this because Merkel was giving a speech at the, you know, the Debbie Das Davos basic event. And at that particular event, she basically said the European Central Bank was independent through gritted teeth, and essentially said that, you know, they didn't really have much to say except that countries should actually behave appropriately, whatever that means. And she said that the actions of loose monetary policy actually take away the incentive for reform, which we all know that. So that's number one. But I think the other thing which is interesting is everybody's assuming this is going to go through pretty unscathed. I'm not so sure about that. There was the European Court of Justice ruling early in the week, which wasn't really a ruling. It was somebody who's the Advocate General saying that all this is above board. I mean, he works for the European Union, so, you know, how the hell is he going to say it doesn't work under the treaties? I'm not
quite actually,
sure.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because my understanding was that the actual outright purchases of bonds of sovereignties was not allowed via the constitution of the ECB. What in the world happened here?
Well, I don't understand it. I've read the judgment, and I'm still none the wiser, or the opinion, rather. I'm still none the wiser. Let's put it this way. I think the person who wrote this was a theologian, and he was actually debating the existence of God. Ah. So, you know, it was kind of impossible to work out what he's doing. Besides which, it's not binding on the European Court of Justice anyway. And people forget that the real issue is not the European Court of Justice. It's the German Constitutional Court. And the German Constitutional Court did something very clever. They said that, according to them, it was basically contrary to German basic law, in other words, German constitution, but they had no jurisdiction, so they kicked it to the European Court of Justice. Now, they're going to wait, and that's not going to happen until December. And basically, once they get that, they still have the option of saying, nah, it's against German law, so we can't actually approve it, in which case, you know, Germany has to dissolve itself and form a new constitution or form an entirely new country. Which is kind of, you know, easy to do. You can probably do that over lunch one day, mm-hmm. and then we can get on with life. The other thing is, people are forgetting the Greek matter is still to come to a head, which is on the 25th, the election, what follows after that. We have the Italian presidential nomination, and Italy, we all know, is a basket case. And the interesting thing is Mediobanca, which is one of the major banks, one of the senior people there, said it would take a nuclear explosion to save Italy now, which is kind of amusing. And then, of course, we have the Spanish elections later in the year. We have all of these things going on. But I think we'll get the lovely Pavlovian market reaction. Everybody will go, cheap money, buy, everything will go up. And somewhere down the track, I think, is going to come the day of reckoning where people are going to go, this doesn't work, does it? And well, that's when the proverbial will hit the proverbial.
Yeah, so when it comes to the idea of, to get back to in the beginning of what you were saying, when it comes to actually looking at what are the benefits of a quantitative easing program in Europe, my understanding is that the first thing is that it's going to reduce the rates on bonds, which are already at record lows. The second thing is, in theory, it would spur on some kind of loans, but again, you're doing it through the sovereign, so I'm not sure what loans. It's not going through the banks at this point. The third thing is you're going to try to bring up inflation, and that happens because you'll have very low interest rates, et cetera. But yet, Europe has been in a deflation spiral with extremely low rates. I mean, essentially, yes, they did knock down the currency a bit during, you know, about, let's say, 2% against the dollar after this announcement. And I don't really understand what the actual mechanics of doing quantitative easing in Europe right now does to take away the deflationary environment and to spur on demand to get them into an inflationary situation.
It doesn't. And I think you mentioned something which is interesting. I think the only real benefit is actually going to be the weaker euro. But that has two rather interesting aspects to it. One is most European trade is within the eurozone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all in euro anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how that's going to help. Now, what it will help is the exporters who export from a European base outside, which is mainly Germany. And Germany has been running the largest per capita and per GDP in percentage terms surplus in the world. So they don't really need much help. And
yeah,
their real problem,
really.
And the real problem is not the weak euro or the strong euro. Their real problem is one of their major markets is actually, which is Russia, has problems with sanctions. And one of its other markets, which is China, has different problems, which is domestically focused in China. So I'm not sure that a weaker euro is going to be the answer. The other second aspect of trying to weaken the euro is, you know, what they're trying to do is export their problem, as we saw in Switzerland. And the other interesting thing about that, they're assuming that nobody's going to retaliate. I noticed with some glee this morning that U.S. officials are now starting to talk about the problems of a strong dollar, which is kind of interesting. I've been waiting for them to say that.
Yeah, they've been awfully quiet, haven't they?
Yeah, they've been extremely quiet because the dollar's up about 15-16% against the euro and about from its low, from about 30% against the yen. And they haven't said a peep,
mm-hmm.
and which is kind of interesting. And now they're talking about it. And I think market investors are forgetting that roughly, 40% of the sales of the S&P 500, 40-50% is overseas. And with weak economies and a stronger dollar, that's going to have some earnings impact at some point in time in the U.S. context. And also that may cut off the actual recovery, which so-called in the United States. And the markets just seem to be completely oblivious to all of this. But look,
By the way, markets are oblivious to this, but yet, in conference calls, in guidance, in commentary, CEOs and various company principals have been talking about how the dollar headwind is a very significant issue. So it's not
indeed
like
it is.
You know, so it's not like it's right. The markets are just looking past that, saying, "Well, listen, what they'll do? Well, they'll fire more people." Don't forget, that's a big thing. That's a big, exciting factor. Unfortunately, when we see that there is a lot of new firing that goes on, and we're seeing that the initial claims have been popping up, even though the unemployment rate's at 5-6, and we're seeing that new jobs have been added at a pretty brisk clip over the last several months. The fact is that if you look at what's going on with oil, which maybe we could segment into, in the oil industry, there's a tremendous amount of layoffs going on around the world.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But I think the best way to rationalize it is when I used to trade for a living, I always said that I could keep only two things in my mind. And I think markets have, in this time-challenged and, you know, attention-challenged age, they can only keep one thing in their mind, and that's loose money. So everything else has basically gone out the window. That's the only way you can rationalize it. But coming to the company layoffs, it's paradoxical because if you lay off people in your economy 60 or 70% consumption, I fail to see if the problem is demand, how that improves demand in the basic economy.
Right. Well, in terms of oil now, let's kind of skip over to this for a second because I had in my last guest, we talked about the issue of supply versus demand versus the Saudis and the Middle East, you know, really pressing down on oil prices. And I think that my biggest concern is if we find out one day that this wasn't all about just the continuing production from the Middle East, but doesn't this whole oil thing, while it does benefit us in a way, in the U.S. particularly, because obviously the falling price of oil is good for us internally, although on the other hand, we see a lot of currencies going down, the oil prices are not such a benefit around the world.
But I think you're absolutely correct. I just make one comment on supply and demand. I think it's about one-third, 40% demand-driven. In other words, weak demand, particularly from Japan and Europe. And I think that doesn't actually augur well. But the other thing about the oil market is you've got to be really careful because the supply-demand imbalance is quite slight. It's 2%. All you need is Libya to go up in smoke or something to happen, and that changes pretty quickly. But leaving that to one side, but I think the interesting thing is how this is going to impact. Everybody's been sort of mesmerized by the $500, $600 of savings in gasoline bills. That's good, and that's absolutely, totally helpful in terms of consumption and so forth. But the reality is, if you look at what the U.S. faces, the U.S. is actually a major oil producer. And certainly the whole shale fracking industry has been one of the growth drivers in this particular period of history. And we are now seeing absolute mayhem in that industry at two levels. One is financial, and the other one is in terms of employment as they try to cut costs. And you know, $500-$600 versus a well-paid job is a completely different dynamic in terms of the economic effect and the amount of investment that's basically gone into that industry, which has been driving growth. So I think now you're going to get some interesting headwinds in the States. One is, I think you're going to see some part of the stock market, the energy park, is obviously going to have trouble, and that's going to flow through into, firstly, the oil services firms, then into the wider economy. And that's going to be, I think, much more significant than people think. The second part of that is the really, in my view, the worrying part, which is we all know that the energy sector has been a big, big borrower. And if you look at the Barclays Corporate Bond Index, they're about 15%, particularly of the non-investment grade. Now, a fair bit of that is actually going to end up in some form of trouble, whether it is that the coverage ratios come down or whether they can't pay it back, only time will tell. And you're not going to see that till probably Q2, Q3, Q4 this year. And, you know, talking to the rating agencies, they're saying they're expecting quite a large tick up in bankruptcies and so forth. Now, that's going to flow through into the banking sector. That's going to flow through into the stock market. And that's going to have some headwinds. The second element is the U.S. is going to get hit through exports. One of its biggest parts is actually the exports to emerging markets. Now, the problem is many of those emerging markets are actually oil exporters. And that's going to become a huge problem for them, because that's obviously going to affect them. Because I don't really get this great ballyhoo about oil, because all that's happening is a transfer of wealth from producers to consumers. It's the same amount of money. It's just going backwards and forwards in a different way. So I'm not sure that it's going to have the kind of positive benefit. And there's one last element that people forget. Historically, what's happened is that the petrodollars, which is the excess oil revenues, has been recycled in capital markets into the debt, initially of developed countries, but more recently into emerging markets debt. And now that's not going to be there. So there's going to be a withdrawal of liquidity pretty quickly, I think. Now, under those circumstances, given you've got a stronger dollar than you've had in the last couple of years, plus potential and possible rising U.S. interest rates, plus the fall in revenue, I think you're going to get some problems in emerging markets. And I was reading some analysis which shows that there's a number of emerging markets which are going to have their corporates and so forth have increased problems, and they're going to be downgraded. So at a minimum, you're going to get some volatility. At worst, you're going to get some defaults. All of those mean there's going to be a lot of headwinds from oil, plus it's going to feed deflation. And, you know, falling prices is not necessarily the end of the world. But if you've got low growth and falling prices and you've got a lot of debt, which the world has, that's not actually a good combination to have at this point in history.
Well, and then also with the falling prices of oil, and a lot of the companies in the emerging markets are owned by the country themselves. They're country-owned companies. There's a lot less money that flows into the system, a lot less money that flows into all the potential for infrastructure development, et cetera. And the fact that if you look at how the dollar has traded, I mean, emerging markets are in pretty tough shape.
Well, you're absolutely correct. I look at emerging markets, and effectively, I think they're in the worst shape I've seen for a fair bit of time. And to my mind, the conditions look spookily like 97, 98, when effectively the Asian monetary crisis occurred, Russia defaulted, and LTCM, long-term capital management, collapsed. And there's three or four eerie parallels. One, a stronger dollar. Secondly, lower commodity prices, and massive, basically, monetary action. In that case, it was by the Bank of Japan, and the currency volatility that flowed from that. And I keep joking with my friends that the emerging markets look fragile, Russia looks dodgy. All we need is an LTCM, and, you know, we'd have a full house.
Well, didn't we have the LTCM with the Bank of the Swiss National Bank?
Well, yeah, actually, if you look at it, that's a very good way to think about it, because the Swiss National Bank balance sheet is basically LTCM's balance sheet. It's
right.
Highly leveraged.
Right.
It owned foreign currency assets funded with Swiss francs, which they'd printed. So, and that volatility that we've seen, I think, is actually a harbinger of what we might see sometime later this year or early next year, because that type of volatility is going to come about because of a whole dynamic. I mean, basically, you have an unstable system at the moment, which is being massaged constantly by central banks. Now, if at any point in time central banks change their policy, which is what the Swiss National Bank did, and the interesting thing about the change in policy is the reason they did it was pretty clear. They thought it was unsustainable, and the risk of losses was such now that it actually overwhelmed any benefit. Now, if you actually look around the central banks around the world, they have exactly the same problem. And so if at some point in time they decide that they can't continue the policy or try to exit, which is what the U.S. is trying to do, nobody else is, or the markets look at them and say, look, these guys aren't going to be there. They're not going to be able to suppress volatility. They're not going to be the buyer of last resort. Then the type of episode we saw with the Swiss National Bank and the Swiss franc could very, very quickly occur, but on a much, much more massive scale. And I think people need to be really conscious of that. But, you know, we live in a sort of Panglossian world, and everybody thinks the world's a perfect place. So it's like the Pharrell Williams songs, Be Happy.
Exactly. But, you know, in terms of the impact of the Swiss dollar situation and also about currency maneuvers, you know, you talk about back in the late 90s how we had the long-term capital management situation. You talk about how that was when, you know, Japan was doing a tremendous amount of monetary work and currency weakening, et cetera. Now, hasn't anyone learned over this entire time that looking at Japan, nothing has been solved at all over all these years with all the money that they put out, and that they just ticked down their, just last week, they ticked down their GDP and their inflation expectations?
Well, actually, it was very funny you mentioned that, because the Bank of Japan governor, Mr. Kuroda, gave a press conference at which, in downgrading the inflation expectation, because he'd assured everybody, he'd guaranteed that they would get to 2%, he'd halved it. And basically, as I read the translation, it says that 1% is the new 2%.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm saying.
Which is very helpful.
But why do they continually do the same exact thing when they know it's not going to get them anywhere where they need to be? I mean, we have massive amount, $4 trillion on the balance sheet of the Fed right now, and inflation is just dormant. Now, maybe what happened is it did, in fact, do something to help a deflation spiral here, but yet at the same time in Japan, they're not seeing any of the benefits. As a matter of fact, domestically, they're a mess.
Look, I think there's several things we can draw from Japan, and one is that, you know, it's not easy to get out of these problems once you get into them, and Japan had lots of advantages, like a huge domestic savings pool and all sorts of other things, like a much more favorable external environment. But going back to your question of why do people do this, one is that one lesson of history, as George Santayana pointed out, is that nobody learns lessons of history,
Right.
And interestingly enough, you know, the Swiss franc move we were talking about, I look back through history, and the closest move, eerily, is the yen in October. On 7th and 8th of October, the yen did something very, very similar. But coming back to why central banks are doing it, one is politicians have vacated the field. They've essentially, they're smart people. They realize that they're on a hiding to nothing. So basically, they pass the ball to the central bankers and go for it, lads and ladies. And essentially, central bankers now are compelled to do something. I think it's a case of, well, we can't do nothing. You know, it would suggest that we're completely impotent and that we can't really do anything. So effectively, they're doing something. And the other answer I hear from central bankers, which is a hilarious justification, is that if we hadn't acted, things would have been worse. And I'm saying, well, why don't you not act and see whether they are actually worse, yeah, rather than keep acting?
Right.
And the really, to my mind, which is really scary, and there's been some interesting papers, William White from the BIS, who was one of the few people who actually got the run-up to 2008 right in policy circles, effectively said, look, these guys have no idea what they're doing. And basically, they're not conducting a bizarre monetary experiment, and he doesn't know how it's going to end. And we've now seen quite a few people, not only in that sort of sphere, but Ray Dalio from Bridgewater came out, and I think for the first time in a couple of years, he sounded extremely worried that, you know, that he thinks that the central banks have A, lost control, B, they don't really know how to end all of this, and the fundamental underlying this, the gambit, the long con, if you like, of all this was going to bring back growth and inflation, which would solve our problems, has failed. So I think he, for the first time, looked a little rattled that this hadn't quite worked according to the rule book.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us are, but yet at the same time, central bankers don't seem to be at all worried about this. Although, you know, I go back to the time when Janet Yellen talked about that, hey, we're going to start pulling the plug on this, and we're going to start looking at maybe a long-term time period, and that could be 6 months or so, and the markets got very upset about that, and then they just pander. That's what it is. I mean, these central bankers are pandering to markets. They're so afraid of equity prices, and who knows what they have in the game on this, you know, whether they own bonds or stocks or what their story is. But I got to tell you something, it's getting to a point of being kind of scary from a long-term perspective. As a market participant, on the other hand, you got to say, well, on the long side, I'm happy about this in the near term. You know, whether it's a day, a week, a month, or 6 months, whatever it is, you know, obviously more potential liquidity, more of stimulus. And the thing that really, I guess, is the thing that hit me about realizing what's going on at the gravity and the of all this. If you were to take a moment of time and not put a date on it and look at a 5.6 unemployment rate and getting better, look at the general consumer confidence indices, look at the manufacturing indices, look at GDP, look at all this good stuff. You would never in a million years, if you had to just pick what should be the appropriate Fed action in the U.S., say that we should be at a zero interest rate with continuing repurchasing of bonds from interest and principal payments back into bonds at this point, you would say, oh, you know, maybe we should be at a 2% or some number. It just seems that we're so loose on policy right now that it's really quite unbelievable.
Well, I think you have to ask a basic question. And the U.S. is doing much better than everybody else. And there was an interesting exchange at Davos last night, which I caught the tail end of, which is Larry Summers.
Now you just made the commentary absolutely meaningless, but go ahead.
Well, yeah. But actually what he said for once made a modicum of common sense. He said he was very worried about deflation, secular stagnation, and he thought the U.S. economy was not doing as well as everybody thought. But the interesting thing was, on the panel was Christine Lagarde, who is the managing director of the IMF, who turned to Larry Summers and said, basically, you know, I hope you're wrong, because that's the only engine on which this jet is flying.
Right.
So, which is really quite scary. And then you go back and say, well, why is the U.S. doing well? As you correctly point out, it's on the back of this massive stimulus, which is ongoing. So the next question is, okay, if we can't continue the stimulus, what happens? And that's a really interesting question. And remember, in 2008, we had interest rates around 3 or 4%, so we could cut those. You know, the balance sheets of the governments weren't as bad, so we could do that. There's a whole bunch of things we could do. Of course, now if you look in the ammunition, you know, a belt, there ain't many bullets left.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing here is that there was almost like a throwaway that Draghi made and an answer to a question, which basically he said, he didn't say it in quite so many words, so I don't want to misattribute him, but he basically was saying, well, look, this is the last throw of the dice. If this doesn't work, well, you know, I think I'll just become a monk and retire to a monastery somewhere because I've had enough.
Yep.
But it's interesting, the market psychology. Hugh Hendry, who runs a hedge fund called Ecolectica, who is one of the smarter hedge fund managers around and very sensible, has fought this for the last 3 or 4 years. And he hasn't done well. And in the end, about sometime last year, he just bailed out. And he essentially said, look, my instincts and everything tells me this is all idiotic, but I can't keep fighting it. So he basically said, well, look, I'm going to go with the herd. And obviously his performances over the last 12 months have been much better. And he used a lovely analogy, which is from The Matrix, the film The Matrix, when Morpheus, played by, I think it's Lawrence Fishburne, says to Keanu Reeves that, you know, which pill do you want to take? The blue pills allow you to basically continue as ever living in this, you know, surreal fantasy, or you can take the red pills, which shows you what it is. But the red pills give you a lot of pain. I think the best way to describe it, and this is the analogy that Hugh Hendry essentially said, is he's stocked up on the blue pills and he's going to keep taking them.
Exactly. I mean, just close my eyes and just go along with it until someday, hopefully, I'm smart enough to get to the point where it breaks. And then, therefore, I will hopefully get on the other side of this. Because, you know, you look at this and you see that how many times we see these big Vs. Dead cat bounces, or, you know, markets coming in, and they come in and you look at it and you see stocks is getting crushed. And then, you know, within days, the market just retreats from the idea of any kind of downtrend and says, okay, you know what, we're going up from here?
I think there's two things that really now drive the way I'm thinking. One is, and I think we've had this discussion from time to time, I think you have to be long volatility because it's going to be incredibly volatile. It's not going to be volatile all the time, but like the Swiss National Bank, like certain events, there's going to be a lot of volatility around those, and they're unpredictable. And you've got to really, the only asset that's really worth having now is volatility, because you don't get paid for anything else. And volatility still is relatively cheap. The second thing is, I think people will look back at this period of history and said, if you manage to preserve your capital, in other words, you made zero return, but you came out of it with the same amount of money that you went in, you look really good.
Yep.
So one way to think about it is flat might be the new up.
Ah, interesting. Interesting to see. Well, we're out of time here. We did get into a lot of different topics. Oil, Draghi's bazooka. And I thought, by the way, I thought the trial balloon that he sent up before, that little leak that came out of about the 50 or so billion euro, and then didn't really affect markets, didn't affect the euro. As a matter of fact, the euro was up on it, maybe a little short covering ahead of it. And then realized, well, we better do something more, and came out with 60 billion. I thought that was a really nice little game he played.
Well, I think the best way to describe Draghi is he's probably the best poker player going around among central bankers. Because he bluffs pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing that I don't understand is everybody knows this pattern of behavior because he does this every time.
Right.
What I don't understand is why people fall for it every time.
Every time. Every single time. And then the outcome is always the same. Well, Das, we ran out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll put all the information on how to get in touch with Das and all the different writings of his books, etc., on the show notes for this episode at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks so much, buddy.
Take care now.
Okay, bye. And that's where we're going to end it this week with some great information from both Tom Wheelwright and Das. Again, make sure to check everything that you can about where to get more information on either of these gents over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll see you next week. Do me one favor. Go over to podcastawards.com and vote for The Disciplined Investor and DH Unplugged for the best podcast in any of the categories that you like. Maybe the People's Choice, maybe in business, maybe in news, wherever it may be. Please make sure to do this. Very, very important. Highly important. Very important. I really appreciate it. Go over to podcastawards.com and vote for both of my podcasts, The Disciplined Investor and DH Unplugged. I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.